calls for a state of emergency in Jacksonville. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, with a new rash of deadly shootings in the city, why lawmakers are calling for the National Guard to come in, and how young people are speaking out against the ongoing bloodshed. You can get on the line and add your voice to the conversation. It's 549-2937 to join us right now. Then later in the hour, looking at our southeastern history of colonialism through the hues of Indigo, a special event at Flagler College. Plus, don't miss it. Later in the show, we welcome best-selling author R.L. Stine of the Goosebumps series. You can meet him in town this weekend at the Jax Book Fest. We'll tell you all about it. All of that ahead, but first this hour, after six homicides in 4 days, community leaders and lawmakers are saying it's time to declare a state of emergency in the city of Jacksonville. State Senator Audrey Gibson and Representative Tracy Davis held a press conference yesterday at a park in the city's northwest quadrant where two people were killed in a quadruple shooting last week. Davis says the city is facing a crisis.
We're in a state of an emergency. The gun violence stealing the lives of our loved ones, wreaking havoc through our neighborhoods, and creating a significant financial impact on our small businesses simply because people are just afraid.
Davis and Gibson at that event called for a citywide curfew of 10 p.m. And they even say calling in the National Guard is not out of the question. Now, against this grim backdrop, tonight here at WJCT Studios, young people will raise their voices about the city's crime wave. It's the One Jack Civil Discourse event, lifting young voices against violence. Here with more, we welcome Nancy Bronner, Executive Director of One Jacks. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Mickey Brown, who manages the One Jack Civil Discourse Project. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And we want your calls too. What do you think about lawmakers calling for a state of emergency, even the National Guard, to come to Jacksonville? And what are your questions about tonight's event here at WJCT, as young people have their say about the city's crime wave and violence and bloodshed in Duval? It's 549-2937 to join us. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and we welcome your comments on Facebook. Nancy Bronner, tonight you'll have young people speaking, along with some adults like Sheriff Mike Williams and Joe Peppers, who heads up the Kids Hope Alliance, Mikai Owen of UF Health. But it's really the young people, I think, that we're really looking forward to hearing from, because so disproportionately, it's our kids who are really being affected so terribly by gun violence and the murder rate in Jacksonville.
That's right, Melissa. We want to focus on and listen to what this violence is doing to our young people. Too often, we adults debate, suggest, do task forces about what we can do to stop the violence, and all of that is needed. But kids are absorbing this. They're hearing it, whether they're seeing it firsthand, hearing about it from their friends, experiencing active shooter drills at school. What is this doing to this generation? That's our focus tonight.
And Mickey Brown, not only will we hear the young people talk about the string of murders in Jacksonville, but also how their whole generation, I think, has been affected by shooter drills in school and the threat of school shootings too, right?
Yeah that's right. What we have come to see in dealing with these young people is that they've been activated by the violence that they are experiencing. Some of them in their neighborhoods, some with the threat of school violence, as you said, the lockdown drills and all of that. And what we're hoping to suss out is, how is this impacting them? This is not the childhood that you and I perhaps remember. So we're talking about 15 and 16 year old kids who are marching, registering people to vote, and also dealing with the everyday threats of violence, looking over their shoulders, being hypervigilant. And that's what we want to hear about from them and how we can help keep them safe.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Jacksonville has been Florida's murder capital on and off for almost 20 years now, Nancy, and violent crime is on the uptick. It's become an issue in the March city elections, where we have candidates on the ballot challenging the current mayor, the current sheriff. You will have Sheriff Williams at this event, so he will be talking about this. And so this is an opportunity for the public to interact with him, too.
Sure. Of course, we want to have the focus being on the young people and listening to their voices. It's not a candidate forum in any way, but we do want the sheriff to share his thoughts on how he can be supportive, how all adults in Jacksonville can be supportive of these young people who are trying to cope with this new reality for them. I mean, they're trying to do homework and think about school things and things that are important to young people. And at the same time, they're having to absorb and process violence in our community.
Let me ask you, Mickey, your reaction to Tracy Davis and Audrey Gibson speaking out yesterday. Not only did they call for the Florida Highway Patrol, even the National Guard to come in, they urged the mayor and the city council to better fund after-school and prevention programs that they say already exist. A lot of them were created with the Jacksonville Journey Initiative some years back to address violent crime. Programs that exist, but critics say aren't funded at the right levels.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, we can look back to the mid-2000s and think about Jacksonville Journey, JCCI's study on murder as well, where there were recommendations on how we could create a more safe community. And that requires funding. And you can talk to certain folks that were involved in the journey, and we can see how that is evolved over all of these years. And yeah, we do have programs. It is possible that we don't have enough. And we hope that our young people tonight will be able to talk a little bit about whether or not there are sufficient resources for them personally, the after school programs, the summer programs, and all of that, to help them to move away from the violence. But we also need to think about how something like calling out the National Guard or having curfews will impact how our city feels. That can be a very enclosed, traumatizing environment that already heightens how vulnerable people feel, especially young people. I mean, no, we live in a country that is free, and you should be able to move about as you will. I can't imagine being 15 years old and you can't be at the mall feeling safe, or you're out at 10:30 and with your parents and you got to run back in the door. Is that the kind of environment we want to create for ourselves and our children?
Sadly, that is the environment for huge swaths of this city. That is the reality, unfortunately.
Yeah, it really is. And one of the things we learned from Dr. Makai Owen in our fall event was the actual brain chemistry change that happens when young people are under this toxic stress, whether it's secondary stress of hearing it on the news or having something happen in their school or in their neighborhood. This actually changes brain chemistry in their such developmental years and vulnerable years. We really have to listen to the young people and what this is doing to them.
Yeah. Tonight, it's One Jax's Civil Discourse Project as they lift young voices against the city's violence. This is an event that anyone can come to, by the way.
Oh, absolutely.
Come on down to WJCT tonight, 7 p.m.?
7 p.m.
And be part of this. And you can be part of the show right now and join the conversation as local legislators call for a state of emergency, a curfew, even the National Guard to come to Jacksonville to stem the tide of bloodshed in this city. We want your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin right now. Hi, Susan. Good morning. How are you?
Yes, I understand it's not a candidate forum, but we are in an election period, and soon we will have possibly a new sheriff. So to invite one of the candidates and not the others seems a little bit of an abuse. And I wonder if the organizers would reconsider and invite Tony Cummings to the event tonight if he was available, because I know he and Anna Broche have been speaking a lot about prevention. And I think that could be a valuable part of the forum on what our leaders are suggesting. But it does sound great, and I'm troubled to hear about the brain chemistry changes. So thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you. As you said, Nancy, this isn't a candidate forum. Still, though, this is a big issue right now for those challenging the sheriff and Mayor Lenny Curry, particularly Sheriff Williams challenger Tony Cummings and Anna Brochet. She's the most high-profile challenger to Mayor Curry, although there are a couple of other candidates, Jimmy Hill and Omega Allen, who have also challenged Curry's leadership on public safety. Sure. So, yeah, what about that?
So we had to make a judgment call about this, and I appreciate Susan's comments because it's something that we carefully considered. When we had the November forum and the civil discourse event, this is a companion piece to that, we did not have the sheriff, and we received a lot of requests and some complaints that we are talking about issues of violence and the sheriff's voice should be in the room. When we did this, planned this event, we don't usually have an active candidate on a panel, but this was so directly connected to the work of the sheriff's office that so many people did ask us to make sure we included him. This is an open public event. Tony Cummings is absolutely welcome. We do want to steer this event to listening to young people and hearing what they are experiencing and what effect it's having on them. We really, there will be candidate forums that others are hosting, and there are opportunities there. But we made the call that it was too important of an issue not to have the sheriff's voice.
James on the north side. Hi, James. What say you? Good morning.
Good morning. I guess, really, you say young people, and I was trying to narrow that down, like under 18. And what side of town is this violence happening on? I've lived here my whole life and never experienced any of it.
Thanks for that. Mickey.
Yeah, the violence, as we saw this weekend, actually, is happening all over town. And I think with the young people that are participating in on this particular panel, these are high school students who have been activated due to the violence that they've experienced firsthand in some cases and or indirectly, but it has still had an impact on their lives. And part of the issue this this evening that they'll be addressing is you don't have to be in a shooter situation in order to experience the violence or what it does to your body or to your brain. Just knowing that there's a possibility that someone could be a shooter in a movie theater, which was an incident that happened several years ago, can affect how you move around and what you do when you are out and about. So we're talking to young people who live in multiple communities. We're also talking to young people who are under 18 because we often think about this as an older young people's issue, but this is all young people. This is all communities. This is all people. And the event that they had themselves back in December was for us to listen to what they are saying because they are wanting to let us know that this is impacting their childhood. When they should be thinking about prom, they're thinking about marching.
Tweets coming into the show. Here's one. The only concern for school children should be to arrive on class on time with supplies ready to learn. They should not have to be watching over their shoulders, listening for stray sounds or being detectives. And lots of emails too. Shannon emails the show. I agree. Jacksonville kids see so much of the violence you're talking about firsthand, but there are also kids involved in crimes who see and know things and say nothing. How do we reach those kids and get them to share the information they have? Will that come up tonight?
It may. It depends on what, you know, we hear from the young people on the panel. But I think we talked about that a little bit back in November in the part one of this work, how we could react to youth violence? How could we eliminate, reduce, what have you? And I think that is something that we all are concerned about. However, tonight the focus is really to talk about the impact of youth violence.
Lee is on the north side. Hi, Lee. How are you? Good morning. Go ahead. Hey, Lee, you're on the air. Okay, Lee, give us a call back. Let's go to another call on the north side. It's Stanley. Stanley on the north side. Go ahead, Stanley.
Yes, good morning. My main concern here is leadership, as I talk about when I'm downtown Jacksonville City Council. The problem that I see is leadership. I am appalled that we are having young people deal with grown-up situations in this country, not only in Jacksonville, but in this country. And I'm appalled by this event. This should be grown-ups conversation. And also, I am appalled that every time something happens in this city, you got the same 200 people dealing with the issue that they cause. Thank you.
Well, Stanley, thanks for that call. But I think he has a point about the same 200 people. I'm not going to disagree with that. But at the same time, I think there's value in letting young people speak out. You know, young people all over the country have become part of a youth protest movement, March for Our Lives, Nancy, around right. this issue. And they are being listened to and they are affecting yeah. policy.
And I agree with Stanley that we should all be appalled that young people are having to talk about this and deal with it. And I agree with you, Stanley, on that. But the young people had their own event. And their opening line was, let us speak, listen to us, because too often the adults are speaking and the young people are needing to have their voice heard about what it's doing to them.
Megan emails the show, I don't think calling in the National Guard to create a police state can help the situation. We need our city leadership and our police force to have a presence in the communities. They should be out in the neighborhoods building relationships and repairing trust that they've lost over the last years. Once a month, walkthroughs are not enough, she says. And Harold is now in St. Augustine. Hi, Harold. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa, and to your guest. You know, this is the root cause of this is a broken and inept welfare system that basically perpetuates pregnancies in the minority community to unwed teenage mothers, over 80%, a continued cycle of generational poverty, and no family structure or accountability. Unless we change that, the violence is never going to stop.
Thanks, Harold. Thank you. Okay, is that going to cut? Now, you're obviously giving the floor to youth tonight, not child welfare and experts, sociologists, anyone who can talk about socioeconomic factors that really drive this. Although you will have Mackay Owen from UF Health. So, the causes of violent crime, I think, poverty, family breakdown, lack of two-parent families, everything that caller mentioned, that's part of what's driving this. So will that come up tonight?
I don't think that will come up, but I do think that when we're looking at violence wholesale, we know what the causes of violence are. I don't think that's new information. But one of the things that we have to understand is violence is happening in all communities in our city and all over the country. And the young people that have been activated, like in Parkland, they see school shootings, they see gang violence, they see national stories about violence. So it's not just about street crimes and criminals. This is about violence happening everywhere in all kinds of ways that our young people are digesting. And what affects them after they've kind of eaten all this up is that they are concerned about their lives and they live in fear. And that is not how teenagers should be living.
Let's go back to Lee on the north side now. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Hey, can you guys hear me now?
Yep, go ahead.
All right. I just wanted to say I think this is an excellent event that's going to happen tonight, and I think the timing is perfect. But my comment was on the curfew and the martial law that the representatives want to enforce, and I don't think that's a good thing. I think when you look at some of these kids who go to work in the afternoons, I grew up working fast food. So if you impose this curfew, I couldn't work. And I think now you're causing subsequent issues. So I don't think that was a good idea. And I just wanted to say that.
Okay, Lee. Yeah. Well, I'm sure the kids will have something to say about that tonight, Nancy. This call for a curfew, a citywide curfew.
Oh, I'm sure they have some strong opinions about that. This is fairly new. I mean, this just happened this weekend, this suggestion. But curfews have been around as a way of controlling violence, and so young people, I'm not sure how much they've experienced with that other than parental curfews, which what kid likes that? But
yeah.
As far as what this does to us as a society, it'll be very interesting to know how the young people are processing that.
Right. For many of them, this might be the first time they've heard of something like that happening. Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, there have probably been curfews called in Jacksonville before. Someone will probably call and educate us about that in a minute. But I don't think recently.
No, I don't think so recently either. And I think to a previous caller's point, should we be imposing curfews and, you know, a martial law situation, or should we be investing more in our young people so that they have appropriate safeties and are able to, for those that are vulnerable to commit the violence, intervention and prevention strategies for them? Which way do we want to go?
Kevin in Riverside. Hi, Kevin. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Hey, yeah. So my thoughts are kind of going to follow the previous caller. I don't think bringing in the National Guard is a very good idea for a few reasons. The first one being, like, police and law enforcement tend to be, you know, responders. I don't think that there's a lot of preventative measures that they take, you know, to stop murders. They're generally responding to it. And I think we're talking about, like, the stress of young people here. I don't think that having, you know, body armored soldiers with fully automatic assault rifles standing on the street corners or at shopping malls is a way to reduce stress among young people. And also, on a moral note, we're supposed to live in a free society and not a police state. And I think there are more productive ways, again, like investing in the young people and after school programs and probably reforming the criminal justice system itself, you know, that would be more effective to improving the violence rate in the city. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Kevin. And, you know, just because lawmakers call for this doesn't mean it's going to happen. But the mere fact that it's being called for is pretty sobering. I mean, this quote from Senator Audrey Gibson, our streets are filled with blood and tears. I believe the funeral homes are the biggest business in Jacksonville right now, she says.
Isn't that the saddest comment? I mean, I read that in the paper and I heard her words. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have a lot of solutions that are just being suggested. Everybody's frustrated. Everybody's horrified. And so the curfew, the National Guard, these are just, I think, ideas put on the table for our community to wrestle with and see what's going to work. I don't think that there's going to be, or at least no one in our country or in the world has figured this out yet. What is the combination of factors, solutions that are going to solve this problem? So I do think it's respectful to listen to these different ideas, but I don't know what we'll land on. And the young people, their comments about what this would do to them. I mean, when we talk to a lot of young people or adults now who come especially from countries that are war-torn and they grew up in this kind of war state or militia state, it has permanent effects on them. And this hypervigilance, you're going to hear Savannah talk tonight about, she's a student at Wolfson. When she walks into any room, any building, she immediately checks for the exits or places she can hide in the event of a shooter. What a terrifying thing to live with. I mean, when I was growing up, it was the, you know, civil defense drills, the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, nuclear war was the big fear.
Yeah,
right.
And I had nightmares.
Fallout shelters.
Right, exactly.
Right, and now, unfortunately, our kids have a different set of nightmares, Mickey, and, you know... now, as Nancy said, the city needs to come to solutions. We've brought this up a number of times on this program. Years ago, the city did institute this massive citywide initiative, the Jacksonville Journey, that was just starting to have an effect on this when it was basically defunded. So this question has been raised on this program more than once by a number of different guests. Why not revive in a more robust way, programs that we know will have an effect. Intervention and prevention programs, particularly for kids after school, more robustly funding the reentry center so that people leaving incarceration don't reoffend, they find jobs instead, and just a number of things that were begun right before the financial crisis, unfortunately. Right. And that have not really continued in quite the same fashion.
Yeah, I think our community, like many other communities around the country, have to ask ourselves tough questions about how we invest in our young people, how we invest in the education and enrichment infrastructure. so that they are, you know, motivated to be the very best that they can be. But and that is an adult conversation. That how do you want it to spend your tax dollars? What kind of programs do we need to create? And being honest about whether or not they work very well. And I know that there's good work happening with Kids Hope Alliance, and you know, kind of I know there's the recent folding of Journey into the Children's Commission to create that. So there's some opportunity there. And I would hope that those folks and the adults in charge will listen to the young people on our panel tonight, but young people throughout our community to understand what it is that they need. That was the thing that came up in their forum back in December. It is we are the ones that are being impacted. So help us to be at the table when there are decisions to be made. Mm-hmm. Come to us.
Another tweet. The previous caller mentioned welfare issues. He's missing the point. He made it sound like a racial issue. There are at least as many, if not more, white Americans in the welfare system as there are minorities. Thanks for that tweet, too. David on the north side. Hi, David. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, I'd love to hear the evolution of the conversation, but that's basically what my comments are about. You know, you can really parallel this to the gun issue with the schools, you know, or proposals to put more guns in schools. Well, we're just sort of, if you will, the house is on fire, and we have all of these code violations, and we're just going to douse it with more water and douse it with more water, but the house is sick. Our culture is sick. And one of the things that I see, and I see a lot from young people, is just this proliferation of a crime culture. We glorify it. We talk about it in music. We, you know, it's really cool to hate the cops and to hate authority and all of these things. And there has got to be a push to stop, you know, the disenfranchisement from the youth and to get them involved in the community. You know, I would love to see police officers that spend time in these communities, firefighters, civil workers, representatives. So, and there's going to have to be funding. And the truth is we're either going to fund it on the front end, or we're just going to bolster up. We're going to get more guns. We're going to get more, you know, heading toward that sort of police state mentality. And, you know, when the representative mentioned the National Guard, I can't help but remember the pictures from the 60s and the 70s with the dogs and the fire hoses, you know, with the National Guard being called into the South. So,
right.
You know, it's an issue that we're going to have to deal with. Our culture is sick. And if we're either going to deal with that, or we're just going to perpetuate the problem. Thanks.
Thank you, David, for those thoughts. Thanks for that.
So we've heard several callers talk about the need for a funding stream. And Melissa, you talked about what happened to the Journey. I was on the Journey mm-hmm. on the one of the task forces mm-hmm. on prevention and intervention. And then the recession hit, and, you know, everybody knows what happened with the funding. There is a debate going on in our community, and it's entering into the political races about a dedicated funding source.
Almost a Marshall Plan, really, for this mm-hmm. city to get at the root of this.
It, you know, sooner or later, there is going to have to be some significant funding stream that is dependable. And I think that is a valid debate, if you want to call a debate, conversation. We do have to figure out how to have a long-term solution to the funding that waxes and wanes over time. And it will. That's just how our economy is driven. But the young people suffer when these programs have to be cut, dollars have to be redirected.
This is all just a preview of what you can hear tonight at WJCT as OneJax hosts its Civil Discourse Project. And by the way, this is an ongoing series where you promote civil discussions about tough issues. So this will be civil, but spirited, as you come out tonight and hear young people lift their voices against the city's violence. This is free, open to the public, as young people take the lead. But also among the speakers will be Sheriff Williams, Joe Peppers, who leads the Kids Hope Alliance, and Makai Brown of UF Health. And so Nancy Bronner and Mickey Brown of OneJax, kudos to you both for putting this together. I'm sure it will be very well attended, unfortunately, for the backdrop we're dealing with. So thank you for sharing the word with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's tonight at 7:00. At WJCT, downtown, across from the bank. Still ahead, best-selling author R.L. Stein? That's later. But up next, the indigo trade, seen through a retelling of this area's history. Find out more right after the break here on First Coast Connect. Keep listening.
In Australia, they aren't building a wall to keep asylum seekers out. Instead, they're shipping them to a small island in the South Pacific.
I can see lots of fences and rocks. Like, everywhere you walk, there's rocks.
And many of the children are falling into a deep depression.
She's sick. She doesn't like to eat. She doesn't like to see anyone.
Australia's refugee crisis. On the next Reveal.
Saturday at 3 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Christina, what's on the front page of today's Times Union?
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers made...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, Radio Reading gives voice to the printed word.
I'm David Luckin, inviting you to listen to the Electro Lounge for the best down-tempo and new jazz at 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday nights, only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a fascinating rethinking of the history around the transatlantic slave trade. In fact, you might call this history through the hues of indigo. Yeah. The history of colonialism in this country was shaped more than you ever might realize by indigo, that coveted natural dye that was traded around the world and was precious. What's this all about? Well, Flagler College will be exploring it with Deeper Than Indigo, a Southeast Textile Symposium. This is coming up later this week. We've got a preview right now as we welcome Laura Mangiovi. She's Associate Professor of Art and Design at Flagler College. Professor, good morning.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're exploring the Southeast United States through the lens of the indigo trade, which is so interesting to me.
Yes.
When I think of indigo, I just think, you know, it was a blue dye that everybody wanted in Europe especially. But what does this have to do with us in the Southeast?
Sure, sure. Well, thank you for having me. As an artist and educator, I'm interested in exposing the origins of a time and place, and indigo is deeply connected to our history in Northeast Florida and Southeast Georgia.
How so?
Well, we had plantations that were developed along the coast. So people were enslaved to produce this product that was labeled blue gold and was traded across the ocean for textiles. So as far as establishing communities, pretty much from New Smyrna up to South Georgia, there's a huge history of communities that were formed off of people who were working the land.
So indigo was produced right here in this area.
It was. It was. There was a Turnbull was probably the most well-known plantation owner that gathered people from Sicily, Greece, and Africa and brought people over to the New Smyrna area. And that is the actually origin of the Menorcan community in St. Augustine.
Was indigo brought them here?
Yes.
Interesting.
They were brought here to work the fields of indigo. Yes.
And how big a crop was it? How much money are we talking about? How big a business was it?
It was
pretty big. Uh-huh. I don't have the exact numbers, uh-huh. But it was, like I said, blue gold. It was coveted by people across the ocean, and textiles were also wrapped into that. People don't realize the significance of having cloth, like the significance of a cloth to cover your body. It's something that when we're born in, we automatically touch cloth. When we die, we're enshrouded and mm-hmm. all in between. Mm-hmm. And cloth was significant for making the sails that pushed us across the ocean to discover foreign lands.
So not only will people learn about the slave trade, but they'll learn about how this slave trade, which was so horrific, actually built the textile industry.
It's all woven together, natural dyes and the textiles. So we'll be exploring the history of indigo in the area, but of course with the history of indigo will come the history of textiles as well.
And this was a really rich space in colonial times. People's clothing, as you said, mm-hmm. was so important mm-hmm. and was sort of a signifier of status. The kind of cloth you used and yes. how it was embroidered or embellished, that was a big deal.
Yes, yes. And we have to realize that that cloth was a luxury. There, many people didn't, and people would rob graves to get clothing. I mean, we take for granted clothing now, right? And we just have throwaway clothing. But that was something, it's a necessity. People don't often realize that. Mm-hmm. And it was something that was coveted. And then when natural dyes were being developed or explored in this country, it became a level of prestige and even, I mean, honor to have your clothes colored a certain color.
Why was the indigo color so prized?
The indigo color was, I think the indigo color was so prized because it was exotic, which is what the origin of most natural dyes, where we can look at, you know, the origin of purple dye that came from ocean life. Red came from a cochineal, a small insect in South America. So the indigo crop was, it was very involved to grow the crop and to process. It wasn't something easy. So if you had the wealth and the power, you can employ people to grow the crop and process the indigo.
Did it take a lot of indigo plants to create just one bolt of cloth, blue cloth?
Right. It's a plant that has to be beaten down, so they would have to build huge vats. So it would be beaten down by people stomping on it, and then it would have to be processed and dried out and made into pucks. So yes, it did. It did take a lot.
I don't think people realize that this was a common thing in this region of the world. This symposium you're having at Flagler, it's the first of its kind, too, isn't it?
It is. So I'm super excited because I'm very interested in the history of textiles and natural dyes. So I've been working on exposing this overlooked history and untold stories of people that were responsible for making the dye.
What are some stories we'll hear?
Well, we have Professor Emeritus Dan Schaefer from University of North Florida. He is an expert in the history of Northeast Florida, of how all of the colonialism was developed with plantations. We also have someone coming from Elizabeth Dubose, coming from South Georgia. And she will also talk about the plantations and the commodity that was happening in South Georgia.
You'll also be talking about local plantations like the Kingsley Plantation.
Yes.
In the Timaquan Ecological Reserve in Jacksonville. How important was it?
Yes. So that's extremely important because we have some artifacts and leftover information of that on the land, you know, of the crop that's still there. There's also original crop seeds in South Carolina as well. And we can see how the way the plantation was laid out, where the people were processing the indigo, as opposed to those who were employing the people who were in processing the indigo.
Now, your keynote speaker is Roland Ricketts, yeah. who's trained in indigo farming and dyeing in Japan.
Yes, yes.
So this was a global trade, by the way.
Yeah, so this is just a very tip of indigo that we're exploring. I mean, it just goes so much larger. So yes, we're very fortunate to have Roland, who has agreed to come down and be our keynote speaker. And he currently teaches in a textile department at Indiana University.
And there's something about indigo that even today is has this mystical quality, isn't there? I mean, people call children with special gifts indigo children.
Mm-hmm, the mystical.
Where does that all come from?
Yeah, well, I think it's through the process, it's also based, it oxidizes. It's a dye that oxidizes. So there's a whole science to it, because when you initially dye with indigo, it looks green. And then when the air touches it, it becomes blue. So there's sort of this magic that happens. And that doesn't happen in any other natural dye.
Did they stumble upon that by accident, I'm guessing? How did they learn to do this?
Well, there was a time period where we were, where humans were exploring, just like exploring with different tastes of food and different agricultural products or in our land, and they were using different plants to see what they did. So some may die, some were good and safe for us to eat, and it was just a matter of exploring a time and a place.
Now, this year's series was specially created for the 50th anniversary of Flagler College. Yes. Not only is this the first ever symposium of its kind, you're celebrating Flagler's 50th anniversary.
Yes.
Which is also something exciting. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So the college has put in place several programs to bring attention to the area where Flagler College is. We prior to this, we had a conference, symposium, and panel speaking on sea level rise. And we're also celebrating those people that have contributed to the college. It's a young college. We're 50 years old.
It is young. It's younger than I realized.
Yeah, not everyone
realizes. I didn't realize it was only 50 years old. You know why? Because it's in these really old, venerated buildings.
Very good point. Yes, for someone that goes there every day, I now see that point. Yes, yeah,
yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's in these beautiful old buildings. Yeah. Flagler's old Ponce de Leon Hotel. Yeah, and it's so old and lovely, you kind of figure, well, this must be like Eden College, and it's hundreds of years old.
Right.
But no, it's 50 years old.
Right, because the history of the site is that it was a hotel. So yes. Yeah.
Well, come on out to Flagler beginning on the 21st. This is Thursday through Saturday as Flagler College hosts Deeper Than Indigo, the Southeast Textile Symposium, investigating the history of St. Augustine and the Southeast through the lens of the indigo trade. This is a robust symposium, 3 days worth of events and speakers, even some field trips too, I think. So lots happening with this.
Yes.
Go to flagler.edu for more, and be part of the Flagler College Ideas and Images Scholars and Artists in Residence program. This symposium is part of that, and they bring nationally and internationally renowned experts to campus. They're building on the tradition established when Henry Flagler's old hotel served as an inspiration for new ideas and artistic endeavors. So Laura Mongiovi, Associate Professor of Art and Design at Flagler College, thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sounds really fascinating. And don't go away. In a moment, we speak with best-selling author R.L. Stine. If your kids love the Goosebumps series, you are going to want to listen to this, how you can meet Stine in Jacksonville this weekend at the Jax Book Fest. That's in a moment. We'll be right back.
Witness over 3 decades of jazz, through 22 top 5 albums, 5 of which hit number 1 on the Billboard charts, The Rippingtons, featuring Russ Freeman, have continued to innovate. Jazz's Magazine has called their debut album the number 1 most influential contemporary jazz album of all time. Don't miss your chance to see The Rippingtons live at the WJCT Soundstage, March 28th. Tickets on sale now at floridatheater.com.
Saudi Arabia ended its ban on women drivers, but women activists remain in jail. And while some women there enjoy their freedom to drive, others would rather be driven.
I have driver. I don't look for parking.
I don't clean my car.
Our reports from Saudi Arabia begin next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Venture capitalists spent billions of dollars on American companies last year. And while many of those startups won't make it,
criticizing venture capital for being too high growth is like criticizing fire for being hot.
I'm Amy Scott. What happens to the startup after it goes under? That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Some folks play sports for money, others play video games. Competitive organized video gaming, also known as esports. It's watched and followed by millions of fans all over the world, and business is booming. The esports champion known as Sonic Fox, on how he reached the top and how esports got so popular. Next time on One Hand. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, beloved best-selling author R.L. Stine is the headliner at this weekend's third annual Jax Book Fest. The creator of the super popular Goosebumps series will speak Saturday at the main library, along with local writers like New York Times best-selling author Brenda Jackson and local activist and author Rodney Hurst. Right now, we're pleased to have R.L. Stine on the line with a preview. R.L. Stine, a pleasure. Good morning.
Well, thank you, Melissa. Nice to be here.
We all have goosebumps having you on our show.
Oh, you had to say it.
I had to say it. You know, I have to ask you, you know, my kids read Goosebumps. They read the series. We went and saw the movie when it came out with Jack Black. What inspired, how did you come up with the idea for Goosebumps?
I just like to scare kids.
So you came up with a scary story.
Yeah, it's a very good job, you know.
And so you are the Guinness World...
I'm kidding, of course.
I know.
You know, I was already doing a teen horror series called Fear Street, which continues to this day. It's kind of hard to believe. Both these series are still going. Goosebumps is in its 26th year. Do you believe that?
That's amazing. You're the Guinness World Record holder for children's horror fiction.
Well, I don't know. I get to scare a lot of generations, don't I?
Yeah, it's really just universally loved and timeless. It just keeps going and going.
Well, it's nice that people like to be scared.
That's right. And kids like to be scared. Why do you think kids like to be scared?
Oh, I think they like to be scared when they know they're safe at the same time. You know, they're having these horrifying adventures. They're being chased by monsters. They're fighting invisible people. And they're in their room reading the whole time.
What are the most interesting things kids have said to you when they meet you about your books?
When they meet me, they don't want to talk to me. They want to shake hands and get a book, and then they want to run away.
They're a little intimidated.
Yes, they do. They get shy and they forget any question they might have, and they just want to get away from me as fast as they can. I get amazing questions. In the mail. The mail is, like, wonderful.
What do they say to you?
Last week I got a letter that said, "Dear R.L. Stine, you are my second favorite author."
Second favorite?
Yeah, that was the whole letter.
Nice.
Talk about keeping you in suspense, right?
Yeah, but hey, it's good to be high on their list. It's good to have kids reading, you know. It's good to have kids reading.
Well, that's kind of the whole point, you know. I don't really want to terrify kids. I mean, the whole thing is to get kids reading. And that's why I do festivals like the Jacksonville Festival and come out and talk to kids about books. And that's why I do it.
I bet a lot of adults love your books, too, though. I bet you're going to have a lot of excited adult horror genre lovers come out to see you as well.
Well, kids who were 10 back in the 90s, we started Goosebumps in 1992. So kids who were, you know, 10 years old back then are in their 30s now. And that's why the Goosebumps movies did so well, really. because the 35-year-olds came to the movie for nostalgia's sake, mm-hmm. and they brought their kids. So, yeah, it took me a while to get used to the fact that a lot of my readers had grown up. That was kind of a shock for me.
Sure.
It's kind of weird being nostalgia, you know?
It is a little weird. What was it like for you to see your books on the big screen, too? What was
that was a lot of fun. I thought Jack Black was wonderful. He wasn't like me in any way, but he was... No, he asked me when I met him. He said, Bob, he said, what about you is true in the script? I said, Jack, not a single thing. And he said, okay, I'm going to play a sinister version of you. And that's kind of what he did in the two movies.
And they were so entertaining. My kids loved them. And so many kids, have really just gotten so much joy out of your writing. And this is really, you know, this event is a celebration of writing and books, which is exciting. Nearly 100 authors coming to the festival.
That.
Yeah, of course.
I always think I'm going to be the only one.
Well, you're the biggest name.
So, I have to share it with 99 others, huh?
That's right. But you are the keynote speaker at the Jacksonville Book Festival, the third annual, coming up at the main library on Saturday. Everything kicks off at 10 a.m. By the way, the tickets for the evening event with you, R.L. Stine, are sold out.
Really?
So if you want to come to hear R.L. Stine at 1 p.m. Saturday at the Hicks Auditorium at the Jacksonville Book Festival, the library says you can start forming a line outside Hicks at 10 a.m. Saturday. The first 60 people in that line will get a wristband so that they can get their book signed by you. And then the first 380 people in line get a wristband for a guaranteed seat at your talk. So people need to show up early to hear you speak, in other words.
Oh, that's great. Well, I hope to see everybody. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It sure is. It's the third annual Jack's Book Fest at the main library this Saturday. Get in line early.
Melissa, I always like going to Florida in the wintertime.
I bet you do.
I'm up here in New York City. It's 23 degrees.
Well, we're pleased to welcome you to sunny Florida this weekend. R.L. Stine, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Again, that is this Saturday at 10 a.m. Get in line early if you want a seat. And that's our show. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. 1A's up next. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, stick around for the Electro Lounge. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.